Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
We're into episode 2 of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, a French philosopher, possibly a little bit pre-Enlightenment, just on the edge of the Enlightenment. Main philosophers are coming in at this point in time, so he's sort of a very early Enlightenment philosopher. Why he's caught my interest in that sort of, it's like the old game of Wikipedia link following, seeing what the old links would get you to. However, that's not as important as looking at Paraguay. Paraguay seems to provide the first sort of evidence-based thing for a philosophy actually simply applied and working. So Paraguay, besides having 90% of its male population massacred and destroyed and pummeled, and poverty and wealth inequality and all this type of stuff, has ranked itself, apparently, according to Wikipedia, as the happiest country on Earth, partly because it's been based on a philosophy of human happiness of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And so I said, I haven't heard of it. And I was told off that, you know, of course other people have heard of him. I unfortunately just was looking out the window at the time that he was mentioned at school, apparently, sort of going into him as a philosopher. So what is really interesting, I suppose, to summarise his life, a bit of turmoil in Calvinist Geneva. So it's interesting to know that Geneva and Switzerland are separate places, different cantons in there. Geneva is an extreme Protestant area, and his mother dies, he's off to education, and he has sort of this classic sexually tensioned education, where he comes out as a printmaker and a musician, and basically a musical person, he's musically connected. So this is, you know, the only musical philosopher. It's interesting that Pythagoras is also into music, but he's a little bit different. And so he basically enters an essay competition, writes an essay to win. And I sort of like essay competitions because they're the idea of fertile questions. So these are open questions where you compete to answer the most. You compete to ask the question the most original way, whereas a pivotal question, this is my philosophy coming through, a pivotal question is a question like, you know, why am I here, I'm in police uniform, the pivotal question is, have I stopped crime today? These are questions that if you answer successfully yourself, you're the best candidate, because you've actually answered the question as desired by society. So you have this pivotal question, this epiphany that self-aggrandizements of society had got out of control, and people were lying and cheating to each other and creating this fiction of progress and art and stuff like that. And so the main aspect is to actually appreciate someone to their peers' competitiveness. And this seems to be the art of evil is competitiveness. So he's come up with a narrative story to man evolving. And I think the entire thing with these narrative stories and these things like this is that nowadays you couldn't come up with a narrative story from the start, because you'd come across as a cult leader, or the academic citation means that if you have a story, you'd have to cite everybody and couldn't go by. He said that there's three different types of love. I can't remember what the word he meant by love is. There's amour de soi, means self-love, which is survival. It gives you the Maslow hierarchy a little bit. There's also pitying love, and then there's sort of envy love. So it's Maslow's series of basic needs, but slewed towards evil. Sort of like an interesting aspect of how you get to evil. And then he has this ideas that with these degrees of love, that having people having, I suppose, different properties, the ideas of states and stuff like that. So he's got different ideas about the state and how you can just basically have life devoid of material desire, one-upmanship, the tall poppy syndrome. So Australia is sort of like the antithesis, actually, really underneath. On the surface, we're really egalitarian. Because we've been a penal colony, it's all about status and how you're seen. Because you've in Australia, you've come in from a state of seeing badly to seeing good. So that journey of being seen is a centre to Australian culture. And it's obviously different to Paraguayan culture, as put by Rousseau. And so Rousseau is, as they say, ultimately pessimistic. He says that the world is just full of phonies and wankers, which is sort of, it's fun. I'm putting my own Australian words into it to describe it. Well, I began reading Until the Light Failed. Going to read again. Fortunately, I've done it here. Conjectural history and moral philosophy. So he's got a history of man. He's got put a conjecture. Now, this is really what you should really put forward, say, for Niels Bohr. He puts it through his conjecture, but he has done a sleight of hand and called them postulates. And really, they are conjectures, would be the fundamental thing. I can see here the pity, essay, love, pity, P-I-T-I-E, I think acute. It's the way discourses on pity. And then amour propre, that's his love is a sexual competition. It's where you decide to cheat. It's sort of like the entire evolution, we call it game theory, about where you where you've got genuine stuff and ungenuine stuff. Let's put a few caveats on it. His entire system was didn't envisage industrialization, didn't envisage communication, IT, information technology, chips and computers, and being able to do things. So if I desire to become interdependent on people, whereas people are becoming pretty independent in this age. The other aspect is that he's basically got the same Rawlsian philosophy. Now, this is sort of like a tour de force in my head, in that in terms of trying to memorize these things or recall these things all the time, I go back and think ahead of time. I say, I can't recall it. And I go through this struggle, this brain damage thing, trying to recall it. Then it sort of comes to me. The fundamental idea that he's talking about is that injustice comes from people gaming the system, and the system operates on multiple levels. So if you have someone on multiple levels, you can't get a universal law. For a state, you need laws, universal law. So you need the state to be completely flushed of all differences between people. And this sounds like a nightmare to me. However, that's it for his system of justice. Now, this is sort of typical of first off the rank, non-academic viewpoint. Nowadays, if you wanted to talk about a system of justice, you would trigger the word system of justice, and peer review would force you to look at all the different systems of justice. So your system of justice is not the first system, it's a system within the systems. So this, the typical system of justice, which addresses what he says, is that you have a law, which is imperfect, However, it's judged equally imperfect by anyone who comes along. So the prisoner, the judge, the jury, the plaintiff, for this law, it's judged as fair if everyone can agree. If you write up a series of rules and then you say, well, now you're this position, you don't know. It's sort of like this double blind test, but in moral philosophy, that is, a double blind test is you don't know whether the medicine that you're giving is real or not, and the person doesn't know whether it's real or not. Therefore, you get the placebo effect. So similarly here, you write a rule and you don't know whether you're going to wind up the rule being applied to you, you're going to be a beneficiary, you're going to apply it, all these things. So there is a mechanism for which this is an insoluble problem, and for this insoluble problem you had to remove all differences. So we've got three different levels of love. Self-love, pitying love, where you go, empathy love, and then there's proper love, you know, this love with passion, where I want to put forward my genes and propagate myself, and in order to do that, if there's a debasement of it, the entire thing goes to poo, and I have to be slick and clever, streetwise, that type of stuff. Okay, taking for this. Okay, nevertheless, it will turn out that subset characteristics are more likely to condemn the social world to deception, dissimulation, dependence, oppression, and domination. So this is proper love. This is the last paragraph. As human populations grow, simple but unstable forms of cooperation evolve around activities like hunting. According to Rousseau, the central transitional moment in human history occurs at a stage of society marked by small settlement communities. At this point, a change, or rather split, takes place in the natural drive of humans to have and care for themselves. Competition among humans to attract sexual partners lead them to consider their own attractiveness to others and how attractiveness associates the genesis of amour proper with sexual competition and the moment puberty, when the male adolescent starts to think of himself as a sexual being with rivals for the favours of girls and women, which is sort of primitive now, and nowadays we would note that a sort of complex societal system from observing chimps and stuff like that, when it goes to a certain point, game theory leads to a natural separation. That's when there's, if you look at stocks and flows about the flow of resources, so this is your basic, this instability as a geographic driver, so as a force propelling people to disperse or propelling them to go along linear features. Rousseau's term for the new type of self-interested drive concerns with comparative success and failures as a social being, amour proper. Love of self, often then rendered by pride and vanity in English translation. So essentially this is your envy. So if I'm okay and the person next to me just get something without working for it, and I have to work my shit ass out of it. It's there. There's sort of a sense of this sort of stuff. The presentation of, say, amour proper makes the central interest of each human being the need to be recognised by others as having high value and treated with respect. The presentation of amour proper in the second discourse, and especially his note 15 to that work, often suggests that Rousseau sees it as wholly negative passion and the source of all evil. Interpretations of amour proper centered on the second discourse, with which historically are the most common ones, for example, Chavet, 1974, often focus on the fact that the need for recognition always has a comparative aspect. So individuals are not content merely that others acknowledge their value, but also seek to be esteemed as superior to them. This aspect of nature then creates a conflict as people try to extract this recognition from others or react with anger and resentment when it is denied them. more recent readings of both the Second Discourse and especially of Emile have indicated a more nuanced view is possible. Den, 1988, and Neuhauser, 2008. According to this interpretation, a more proper is both the cause of humanity's fall as well as the prompt for its redemption because of the way it develops humans' rational capacities and their sense of themselves as social creatures, among others. Although Rousseau, it's amazing that he's written a novel, you know, written operas and novels and his essays. This is whereas nowadays you publish or die, you publish in it, and it sort of kills it all. Laura Rousseau held that the overall tendency socially, historically, is for a male proper to take on toxic and self-defeating inflamed forms. He also held that there are at least, in principle, ways of organising life, individual education, that allows it to take on a benign character. This prospect contains, this is the entire thing, is that this is another aspect of Rousseau, that he sees that there is this link between the educational sphere and the political sphere as both constructs which can become toxic. Like, you know, Nazism and, yeah, schools. This prospect of containing or harnessing amour propre finds expression in both The Social Contract and Emile. Some works, such as Second Discourse, Rousseau presents. Okay, that's page 2. Page 4. Page 3. Okay, just getting myself up. This is the joy of turning on page numbering. Guys, obviously it doesn't matter to you because you're just listening in the inky blackness, inking, swirling chaos of the internet. Like, it's the internet plus COVID virus plus, you know, other worries, financial worries that you've got out there. I bet people are being nasty to you in some part. You wouldn't be listening to this if you were completely content. You would have no need of philosophy. It's pretty amazing. Amour propre as passion that is quite distinct from our moral despair. So this is, you know, to love yourself, to basically need to eat and stuff like that. And then there's another need to actually let down someone else's bloody towers. It's hard to say, look, I suppose I've been exposed to extreme stuff. I used to routinely, before going into a test, have to come in and people would put lacquer on my batteries of my calculator. And I'd go in, look at it, fix it straight away, and people would look at me. But in terms of that, I've been experienced the ML proper, though it's love proper, but it's love of yourself proper and hatred of other people. In others, including Emile, he presents a form of ML de soi takes in social environment. In the latter, that is consistent with his view that in Emile, that all passions are outgrowths or developments of amour de soi. Although amour proper, which is, you know, spiking the opposition, has its origin in sexual competition and in comparison within small societies, it does not achieve full toxicity until it's combined with a growth of material interdependence amongst human beings. Yep. Well, basically, I think people have said, oh, look, God, look at that domestic cow, a domesticated cow. Oh, who's looking after that? A domesticated human, i.e. a slave. I think we've got to see that slavery is just an outgrowth of domestication, that we've said, hang on, we can't. Sort of like we, like, humans as food is cannibalism, humans as service is slavery. So with still a bit of cannibalism, but we don't have to eat people as much because we've now got chicken farms. We don't perhaps have to exploit people because we've got computers, maybe as sensible. So if you're out spending your, like, it's humans are very expensive to eat for various reasons. They tend to resist being killed. and that tend to resist being very efficient workers, my own view. And the discourse on inequality, Rousseau takes the growth of agriculture and metallurgy and the first establishment of private property together with the emergence of inequality between those who own land and those who do not. In an unequal society, human beings who need both social good of recognition and such material goods as food and warmth become enmeshed in social relations which are inequal to both to their freedom and to their sense of self-worth. Subordinates need superiors in order to have access to the means of life. Superiors need subordinates to work for them and also to give them recognition they crave. In such a structure, this is proto-communism, isn't it? In such a structure, there is a clear incentive for people to misrepresent their true beliefs and desires in order to attain their misinterpretation. Misrepresentation and frustration receives its clearest treatment in Rousseau's account of the figure of the European minister. Towards the end of the discourse on equality, a figure who needs to flatter others in order to secure his own wants leads to the alienation of his own self. Well, this is the entire thing. This is, like, we are really, in my sort of view, we're in cottage industry education, and it's in full swing. The feudal system is in full swing, and it's a point to actually just put it aside and turn the page on this feudal education system. Obviously, I have my own set of life experiences, and I want to sort of map. Obviously, you map your experiences into what you read. 2.1, morality. Amour de soi, that's the basic, the survival. Amour propre, which is sexual, and amour pitié is you poor bastard. Are not the full complement of passions in Rousseau's thinking. Once people have achieved consciousness of themselves, the social beings, morality also becomes possible, as this relies on the further faculty of conscience. One of the things is to run a model, your modelling of the future. So you need information, the ability to model, and a prediction of the future, and being able to differentiate decisions as outcomes, which is there. Now, the fullest account of Rousseau's conception of morality are found in the letters morales and sections of the Confessions of Faith of the Savoir Vicar, a part of Emile. Some of these books sound good, but when you actually read them, they're just tedious. In the most primitive forms of human existence, before the emergence of amour propre, pitié balances the restraints of self-interest. Wow. It is, to that extent, akin to moral sentiments such as human sympathy. So, David Hume is this idea of sympathy. But as something that is merely instinctual, it lacks, for Rousseau, a genuine moral quality. Genuine morality, on the other hand, consists of application of reason to human affairs in a quasi-aesthetic manner. I would tend to agree. If you can't reason, you can't be ethical, because ethical is an outgrowth, a reason good. This requires the mental faculty that is the source of genuine moral motivation, namely consciousness. Conscience. Conscience impels us to love, justice, and morality in a quasi aesthetic manner. I may have misread that. As the appreciation of justice and the desire to act to further it, conscience is based on a rational appreciation of the well-orderedness of a benign God's plan for the world. However, in a world dominated by inflamed amour propre, that is, absolutely everyone's a bastard after themselves and wankers, the normal pattern is not for morality or reason to supplement or supplant our natural proto-moral sympathies. Instead, the usual course of events in civil society is for reason and sympathy to be displaced by the human's enhanced capacity for reason to put at the service, not of morality, but the impulse to dominate, oppress, and exploit. For recent discussions, Rousseau on Conscience and Reason, see Needleman, 2017. So, basically, he's one of these things that obviously you look around and people are screwing each other, lying, they're doing stupid things, they're sort of trashing the environment, all that type of stuff. So you can say there, and evidently. We can't really reset people. So I sort of agree with this that we to get to a different system outcome, system configuration, we're sort of locked into it. So I think there is advantage in that the mayor one day is the mayor the next day, and that type of stuff. You know, this continuity. Been locked into a system is like a memory of a system. Like you remember that yesterday you're a policeman, today you're a policeman, tomorrow you're a policeman. Society remembers that, and it's got ways of keeping that memory and coherence. It also means it's inflexible. So you know you have a policeman's uniform. There's that. The language and memory. It is interesting that language is a form of memory. It's amazing. Okay, section 3, political philosophy. Rousseau's contributions to political philosophy are scattered among the various works, most notable of which is A Discourse on the Origin of Inequality, The Discourse on Political Economy, The Social Contract, Considerations of the Government of Poland. Obviously, everyone needs to consider the Polish government. But the idea of social contract is this idea of people trying to work out why is a king. And they can say, it's a king, that's a king, and no king. So look at the two differences. Generally, with no king, it's descended into civil war and invasion, and there happens to be lots of wars. And therefore, you say, well, king has this effect, and you sort of infer, you make conjecture. However, many of his other works, both major and minor, contain passages that amplify or illuminate the political ideas in those works. His central doctrine in politics is that the state can be legitimate only if it is guided by the general will of its members, and the idea that finds most dedicated in the social contract. So this is pre-Enlightenment, I think it's Locke, that someone's king basically because society's agreed, but once society, it's so Locke was the basis of the French Revolution, where people say there's no divine right, it's an agreed right. Okay. The social contract, Rousseau sets out to answer what it takes to be the fundamental question of politics, the reconciliation of freedom of the individual with the authority of the state. This reconciliation is necessary because human society has evolved to a point where individuals can no longer supply their needs through their own unaided efforts, but rather must depend on cooperation of others. Okay, so this is beginning to change in that you can just give money to someone and they can just shut up and go away and be productive in their own world. You know, the state sort of disappear. And this reconciliation, the process whereby human needs expand, interdependence deepens, sets out in the Discourse on the Origins of Inequality. In that work, the final moment of Rousseau's conjectural history involves the emergence of endemic conflict among the now interdependent individuals, and the argument that the Hobbesian insecurity is the condition that would lead all to consent to the establishment of the state authority and law. So Hobbes was basically an English philosopher in the Civil War and Restoration period, and he had various books, Protestant books, but basically he said, people choose the king because without the king you're just going to kill each other. So therefore part of the social contract is that the state will come in and stop your brother killing yourself, stop all that slaughter. So it's sort of the idea that you live with a whole bunch of rednecks and they're so stupid the only thing they can believe is a bully outside. So it's the bullying, it's sort of like a bully-based society. So everyone would smash up and root everyone. So what you do is you have a big bully, and that is you outsource bullying. That's my overall view. Don't read that. That's just an Australian's view of the pommies. In this work, the final moment of Rousseau's contextual history, that is, I love the idea of contextual history, involves the emergence of endemic conflict among the now independent individuals and the argument that Hobbesian insecurity of this condition would lead all to consent to establishment of a state authority and law. In the second discourse, this establishment amounts to the enforcement of unequal exploitative social relations that are now backed by law of state power. This is just before the French Revolution. In the second discourse, this establishment amounts... it's an echo of Locke and an anticipation of Marx. So John Locke says that, you know, essentially this is how the state operates. The state operates in an unfair way. And Marx, the conjectural history is sort of similar to dialectical materialism, and I didn't realise that. What the dialect is you have a conversation, and a learned conversation is just so high value. Rousseau argues that the state would, in effect, be a class state guarded by common interest of the rich and propertied, and imposing unfreedom and subordination on the poor and the weak. The propertyless consent to such a settlement because of their immediate fear of a Hobbesian state of war led them to fail to attend to the ways in which the new state will be systematically disadvantage them. Which is bloody true. Except I think now people are just... I just think being wealthy makes it fucked in the head in general. 3.1, the idea of general will, which is really interesting. There's the will, the machismo, fascist will, the power of life, the will to assert, and this is a different type of will. Rousseau's account of the general will is marked by unclarities, and I like that. That is an unclarity. I love that. I'll use that term if I can bloody well remember. I think what you've just said there is an unclarity. It's just, rather than just saying it's rooted, you just say, I think you've just said something there. Not that it doesn't make sense. Not that it could be clearer, but it is an unclarity. I love that. And ambiguities that have attracted the interest of commentators since its first publication. The principal tension is between democratic conception, where the general will simply is simply what the citizens of the state have decided together in their sovereign assembly, and an alternative interpretation where the general will is the transcendent incarnation of the citizens' common interests that exists in abstraction from any of them actually wants. Bertram, 2012, which is true. It's sort of like if you voted, who wants a lockdown? You held a general thing. It's sort of like everyone would vote against it, or there'd be sufficient to vote against it, and you'd just have to have shit. Both views find some support in Rousseau's texts, and both have been influential. Contemporary epistematic conceptions of democracies often make reference to Rousseau's discussion in Book 2, Chapter 3, The Social Contract. These accounts typically take Cordat's jury theorem as a starting point, where democratic procedures are conceived as a method of discovering the truth about public interest. I'll just have a bit of a chat after this about the complexity of Australian tracking apps and security, and oh, it's just amazing to go through. So it seems very simple, but we live in a place where we've got an aggressive players out there, be it Facebook or the Chinese government, which sort of this is just unfortunately a bit naive nowadays. They interpret the general will as a deliberative means of seeking the outcomes that satisfy the preferences of individuals and renders the authority of the state legitimate. The tension between democratic and transcendental conceptions can be reduced if we take Rousseau to be arguing for the view that under the right conditions, the procedures are absent. When procedures are absent, the state necessarily lacks legitimacy. On such reading, Rousseau may be committed to something like a posteriori philosophical anarchism. Such view holds that it is possible, in principle, for the state to exercise legitimate authority over its citizens, but all actual states, indeed all states that we are likely to see in the modern era, will fail to meet the conditions of legitimacy. Well, this is hard to say. It's an amazing thing. So we have these things where we've got the problem with open source apps and the Chinese government and these complexities. Like, I'm not a redneck. However, there is this thing that I have noted in that is sort of distributed control or virus. It's not necessarily the app. It's really hard to actually force it to do something. It's the requirement to have complete control of the development system. So what generally happens is that you can have viruses which are activated by cookies. So the virus can sit there and it can start to use cookies, all these legitimate low profile. So you can get this sort of a series of low profile systems which can operate in really complex ways and set up. And so in order to do that, you need a firewall around this type of stuff. And all this is way, way technically beyond people's understanding. And I think there's a lot of technical aspects of just electricity, sewerage, testing, freedoms, stuff like that people cannot possibly understand the technical world they live in. And so the state can try to be legitimate, but in essence, it just doesn't have the bandwidth. You just can't actually sit down for 3 hours in a day and try and educate someone to why you're doing something. It's become so complex just in what it is, and trying to stop other people, trying to stuff it up. It's just become really complex. It's like doing your own open heart surgery. Rousseau argues that in order for the general will to be truly general, it must come from all and apply to all. This thought has both substantive and formal aspects. And I sort of, just what I said is that it can apply for more, but really things have become so technically complex and with vulnerabilities in it from bad actors who are really against you, that it really can't come from all. To come from all, it requires all to understand. And although this is a technical world, it's complex. Come on around here. Okay. Rousseau argues that the law must be general in its application and universal in its scope. The law cannot name particular individuals, and it must apply to everyone within the state. Rousseau believes that this condition will lead citizens through, guided by a consideration of what is in their own private interest, to favour laws that both secure the common interest impartially and that are not burdensome or intrusive. For this to be true, however, it has to be the case the situation of the citizens is substantially similar to one another. Okay. In a state where the citizens enjoy a wide diversity of lifestyles and occupations, or where there is a great deal of cultural diversity, or whether it's a high degree of economic inequality, it will not be generally be the case that the impact of laws will be the same on everyone. In such cases, it will often not be true that citizens can occupy the standpoint of the general will merely by imagining the impact of the general and universal laws on his or her own case, which is this Rawlsian philosophy that it might be hard to do, but that's what you have to do. You have to be run it through, which is I sort of think that laws and fertile questions, formulation of laws as fertile questions, might be the way to do it. It's interesting that say our Senate inquiry puts out fertile questions and asks for everyone. It's sort of like an essay competition, Senate inquiries. I just don't think people understand them enough. And the great thing about it is that you can write shit and put it up, and they have to read it and acknowledge it. You know what you write. You can. There's no limit to the number of people who can write a Senate inquiry. They just have to. So, if you like, well, at least in Australia, if they announce, "Oh, we're having a Senate inquiry on computers and schools. Anyone wants to write?" Oh, such. They're really sort of quiet about it. But once you find out about it, you can write what you want, and it gets published, and everyone has to read it. It's quite incredible. Okay, in the social contract, Rousseau envisages three different types of level of will as being in play. This is just without reading this ahead. Four levels is a general thing, sort of. Level 1, level 2, relationship between level 1 and 2, and a knowledge of that relationship is that fundamental aspect. The first, individuals all have private wills corresponding to their own self-interests and natural individuals. Second, each individual, insofar as he or she identifies with the collective whole, assumes some identity of citizens, wills. The general will of that collective as his or her own, setting aside selfish interests in favour of a set of laws that allows all to coexist under equal freedom. Third, very problematically, a person can identify with a cooperative will of a subset of a populace as a whole. The general will therefore both a property of the collective and a result of its deliberation, and a property of the individual insofar as the individual identifies as a member of the collective. In a well-ordered society, there's no tension between private and general will, as individuals accept both justice and the individual's self-interest require the submission to the law, which believes that many societies will fail to have this well-ordered character. One way in which they can fail is if private individuals are insufficiently enlightened or virtuous, and therefore refuse to accept restrictions on their own conduct, which achieves collective interest. Another role of political failures arises where the political community is differentiated into fractions, perhaps based on class division between rich and poor, and where one fraction can impose a collective will on the state of the whole. So, how many did he say? Three, and there are three different types of will. So let's try and do it. There's your individual will, your collective will, and it's a version of collective will where you've got to make it a subset of people, and it's going to fail. That's a bit too much for me to understand. The social contract harbours. So the social contract is Hobbes, the idea in that I will pay a fine if I'm asked to. I will do things if I'm asked to, but in reward, the state will come along and that policeman will then protect my property from people. The social contract harbours a further tension between two accounts of how the general will emerges in relation to private wills of citizens. Sometimes Rousseau favours a procedural story according to which the individual contemplation of self-interest is subject to constraints of generality and universality under the propitious sociological background, conditions such as rough inequality and cultural similarity will result in the emergence of a general will from the assembly of the citizens. In this account, the emergence of the general will, there seems to be no special need for the citizens to have any specifically moral qualities. Which is interesting, because if you live in a village of wankers, just expect to be outspoken. Like, if they don't like you, they can't do maths, and you want to say maths, they just will screw you. The constraints on their choice should be enough. However, Rousseau is also clearly believes that the mere contemplation of self-interest would be inadequate to generate a general will. This may partly concern issues of compliance, since selfish citizens who can will the general will might still not be moved to obey it. Just like lockdown, that these complete knobs go around on motorbikes in the bush. Oh, I just can't describe these rugby players, just not smart enough to obey. They need to, I don't know, but which his figure of the legislator is one attempted solution. As a believer in the plasticity of human nature, Rousseau holds that good laws make good citizens. I would definitely say so. I think that's the fundamental thing, is this a law? Is this going to make a good citizen, or is it a punitive law? However, he also believes that good laws can be willed by good citizens, and that in order to be legitimate, they must be agreed upon by the assembly. This puts him in some difficulty, as it is unlikely that citizens who come together to form a new state will have the moral qualities required for good laws, shaped as those citizens will have by unjust institutions. The legislators or lawgivers, therefore, has the functions of inspiring a sense of objective identity in new citizens that allows them to identify with the whole and be moved to support legislation that will eventually transform them and their children into good citizens. In this story, however, the new citizen at first lack the capacity to discern good reason that support new laws, and the lawgiver has to persuade them and by non-rational means to legislate in their own best interest. Which is sort of like a description of the Australian Public Service. This is why you don't want to politicise your public service, because that's the only grounds for good laws, good moral laws to come out. We should give people a mark out of sort of a two-level mark. We can only mark them for how much they know. We should give them a mark for how much they're not a wanker. Rousseau's 3.3, Rousseau's claim to reconcile freedom and authority. What then of Rousseau's key claim that freedom and authority are reconciled by his ideal republic through obedience to the general will? This claim finds notorious and deliberately paradoxical expressions in Book 1, Chapter 7 of The Social Contract, where Rousseau writes of the citizens being forced to be free when they are constrained to obey the general will. The opening words of The Social Contract themselves refer to freedom from the famous saying, "Man is born free, but is everywhere in chains." It's beautiful. This ring declaration, however, is almost immediately followed by a note of paradox. Rousseau declares that he can make this subjection in change legitimate. The thought that Rousseau's commitment to freedom might not be all that it first appears is strengthened by other passages in the book. Most notably, his declaration that those subject to the general will are forced to be free. The value of freedom or liberty is the centre of Rousseau's concerns throughout his works. Since he uses the notion in several distinct ways though, it is important to distinguish several uses of the term. First, we should note that Rousseau regards regards the capacity for choice and therefore the ability to act against the instinct and inclination as one of the features that distinguishes the human race from the animal species and makes a truly moral action possible. Now, it's interesting about whether Descartes believing animals had a spirit. Isn't that amazing? It's interesting to consider this in René Descartes. This makes possible both the development of the human species and also the fall from grace, since individuals can ignore benign impulses, such as pity, if they wish to. The freedom to act contrary to the mechanisms of the senses and the power of willing and choosing is, for Rousseau, something entirely outside the laws of the physical world, and therefore not subject to scientific explanation. Rousseau also takes this freedom to choose and act as the basis for all distinctively moral action. The social contract and the connection between freedom and choice and morality is central to his argument against despotic governments, where he writes that the renunciation of freedom is contrary to the human nature, and to renounce freedom in favour of another person's authority is to deprive one's actions of all morality, which is essentially, if I can say, I suppose I've got my view of a despotic state as the education department in my head. Okay, in Book 1, Chapter 8, The Social Contract, Rousseau tries to illuminate his claim that the formation of a legitimate state involves no net loss of freedom. But in fact, he makes it a slightly different claim. The new claim involves the idea of an exchange of one type of freedom, natural freedom, for another, civil freedom. Natural freedom involves an unlimited right to all things, an idea reminiscent of Hobbes' right of nature in Leviathan. So Hobbes is an English philosopher. Leviathan sounds like a real dirge of a book. It's gotten me in real sorts of trouble, poor old Hobbes. Since all human beings enjoy this liberty because of any individual capacity to get what he or she wants, will be limited by his or her own physical power and completing physical power of others, which is really interesting because you're looking at disabled people and blind people. Obviously, they're in a more complex space. Further, inevitable conflict over scarce resources will pit individuals against each other, so that the unhindered exercise of natural freedom will result in violence and uncertainty. The formation of state, the promulgation of laws, willed by the general will, transforms this condition. With sovereign power in place, individuals are guaranteed a sphere of equal freedom under the law with protection of their own persons and security properties. I can sort of see this, to me, immediately imagine a stable sort of equation for allowing things to go in this energy field around people. In my head, I immediately see that. Provided the law bearing equally on everyone is not meddlesome or intrusive, Rousseau believes that it will not be. Since no individual has the motive to legislate burdensome law, there will be a net benefit compared to the pre-political state. And yeah, this is really interesting because there's almost there's too much. It's gone from silence of not knowing anything. The serfs in the fields you've seen from the castle to every serf on Facebook coming through. Rousseau makes further claim in the same chapter of a social contract, namely that conditions of civil society and citizens achieve moral freedom, by which he means obedience to the law that one has prescribed to oneself in discussion, especially Neuhauser, which sort of interesting is that there's no one in Australia has to follow an unjust law. If you break a law and it's unjust, you go to the High Court and say, I didn't follow the law, why? Oh, it's unjust. And then they look at it and they say, oh, yeah. Or they look at it and say, no, but this is how you should go. So this idea of oh shit, there's an unjust law is pretty amazing. Achieves moral freedom, by which he means obedience to the law that that one has prescribed to oneself. Although this latter claim is presented almost as an afterthought, in this form of freedom, most directly responsive to the challenge Rousseau had set for himself two chapters earlier, which involved finding a form of association in which each citizen could obey only himself. Naturally, this raises the question of whether the citizen does in fact obey only himself when he obeys the general will. On the face of it, this claim looks difficult to reconcile with the fact that majorities and minorities with democratic states, since those citizens who find themselves outvoted could seem to be constrained by the decision which they decree. Rousseau's solution to this puzzle is found much later in Book 4. Much later in Book 4, find themselves outvoted would seem to be constrained by decision in such a degree. Rousseau's solution to the puzzle in Book 4, Chapter 3, The Social Contract, where he argues that those who obeyed laws they did not vote for remain bound by the will that is their own, since democratic process has enabled them to discover the content of the general will in which they share. Many commentators have not found this argument fully convincing, which is stuff like that. In general, there's sort of this dichotomy, and obviously if a dichotomy is unfair, you find another theme, another way of going through it. It's complex system analysis. Rousseau's invocation of three types of freedom, natural, civil, and moral, in the text of his Social Contract can appear confusing. So he's got three types of love, which is self-love, piteous love, and oh, love. Oh, I am the greatest. In the text of the Social Contract can appear confusing. The picture is further complicated by the fact that he also relies on a fourth conception of freedom related to civil freedom but distinct from it, in which he nowhere names explicitly. This is republican freedom, and consists not in my being subject to my own will, but rather in the fact that the law protects me from being subject to the will of any other particular person in a manner of a slave or serf. To find Rousseau's explicit endorsement of this idea, we have to look to not to the Social Contract, but rather to some of his unpublished notes. Yet, the concept is clearly implicit in the notorious "force to be free" passage of Book 1, Chapter 7, since he there explains that each citizen is constrained to obey the general will. He is therefore provided with a guarantee against all personal dependence. Really interesting fact. Very interesting fact. Okay, representation and government. One feature of Rousseau's political philosophy that it has proved at least pervasive to later thinkers is his doctrine of sovereignty and representation, with his apparent rejection of representative government. At the centre of Rousseau's view in the Social Contract is the rejection of the Hobbesian idea that people's legislative will, changing it, can be vested in some group or individual that then acts with their authority but rules over them. Instead, he takes the view that the hand over one's general right of ruling oneself to another person or body constitutes a form of slavery, and that to recognize such authority would amount to the abdication of moral agency, which is essentially Yeah, well, basically, you can't get past a knob and a wanker. They will just, you know, stuff you up. And this hostility to the representation of sovereignty also extends to the election of representatives to foreign sovereign assemblies. Even where those representatives are subject to periodic re-election. Even in that case, the Assembly will be legislating on a range of topics on which the citizens have not deliberated. Laws passed by such assemblies, therefore, would bind citizens to terms they have not themselves agreed upon. Not only does this representation of sovereignty constitute for Rousseau a surrender of moral agency, widespread desire to be represented in the business of self-rule is not a symptom of moral decline and loss of virtue, which is essentially it. And I sort of got a unique insight by looking to these sort of right-wing oldies sending me internet crap, and this is not the society to mellow them. No one's speaking to these people to educate. As essentially, whether you've got an uneducated parliament, an uneducated society, no matter what you do, there's no magic thing you can add to them to make them more educated. That's my view. The practical difficulties of direct self-rule by this entire citizen body are obvious. Such arrangements are potentially onerous and severely limit the size of legitimate states. It is noteworthy that Rousseau takes a different view in a text aimed at practical politics. Consideration of the government of Poland, nevertheless, is not entirely clear that the widespread interpretation of Rousseau as rejecting all forms of representative government is correct. On the key distinctions in the social contract between sovereigns and sovereign and the government. The sovereign, composed of people as a whole, promulgates laws and expression of its general will. The government is a more limited body that administers the state within the bounds of the laws, which issues decrees applying the laws in particular cases. If the laws are conceived of as the people setting a constitutional framework for society, the government decrees comprising the more normal business of legislation, then the distance between Rousseauian republic and a modern constitutional democracy may be smaller than it first appears. Yeah, did you say constitutional democracy? Yeah, so the basic constitution is what we've agreed is the will of the people, and then you can produce laws amongst them. You do have the problem of these people producing it, but then you have news polls going on. In effect, but see, the laws are so technical, like taxation is so technical, superannuation is so technical that people really don't understand it. In effect, the institutions of the sovereign may be inconsistent with the representative bottom, where the executive power of the government can be understood as requiring. Such a picture gains credibility when the details of Rousseau's views on governments are examined. Although a variety of forms of government turn out to be theoretically compatible with popular sovereignty, Rousseau is skeptical about the prospects for both democracies where people conduct the day-to-day running of the state and the application of laws and monarchy. Instead, he favours some form of elective aristocracy. In other words, he supports the idea of day-to-day administration should be in the hands of a subset of population elected to them according to by merit, which is merit, or you can be elected by merit, or your merit can be established by qualifications. Two important issues arise in relation to Rousseau's account of relations between the sovereign and government. The first of these concern his political pessimism, even in the case of the best designed, most perfect republic. Just as any group has a collective will as opposed to the individual private will of its members, so does the government. As the state becomes larger and more diffuse, the citizens become more distant from one another, both spatially and emotionally. So the effective government of a republic will need a proportionality of smaller, more cohesive groups of magistrates. Rousseau thinks it's almost inevitable this group will end up usurping the legitimate sovereign power of the people and substituting its corporate will for the people's general will, which is, to me, speaks to lobbyists, doesn't it? The second issue concerns how democratic Rousseau envisioned his republic to be. He sometimes suggests a picture in which the people would be subject to elite domination by the government, since the magistrates would reserve the business of agenda setting for the assembly to themselves. In other cases, he endorses a conception of a more fully democratic republic. Although Rousseau rejects Hobbes's view of the sovereign as representing or acting in the person of the subject, he has a similar view of what sovereignty is and its relation to the rights of the individual. He rejects the idea that the individuals associated together in political community retain some natural rights over themselves and their property. Rather, such rights as individuals have over themselves, land, and external objects, are a matter of sovereign competence and decision. Individual rights must be specified by the sovereign in ways that are compatible with the interests of all in just polity. Rousseau rejects the idea that the rights could be insisted on as a check on the sovereign's power, which is Bill of Rights or, First Amendment, that type of stuff. It is interesting in that, what Australian citizen is, in that, sort of like the land and everything is really owned ultimately by the government. You can have a claim on it and be compensated for your claim, but it's ultimately owned by the government. If you strike oil in your property, well, you don't own it. That's the state's oil. Yeah, if you find a nugget of gold on your property, it's the state's one. But you get by a license to get that gold. So the state says, look, I don't know where that gold is. You tell me, you're going to find that gold. It's like if you, I suppose, basically, if you find some gold on your property, say if I just was digging the garden and I dug up a golden nugget, that nugget would be the property of the Australian government, of everyone. All right. But I have to then cover it up and say, oh, look, I want to get some gold here, and then you can dig it up, and then you say that the state, you have bought the right to that. It's fairly complicated. Also, like, you don't have the space above you and stuff like that, and they can legitimately order you off your property. I don't know how the people in the United States would like that in terms of, there's a fire here, oh well, we can order you off the property in order to save life. You can't order. The Australian state can order you to do things, but it must be legitimate. There you go. Whereas, so essentially, you can have any law you like, and if it's fundamentally unjust, you don't have to follow it. You can't risk and do it. It's much better. There's a ways of not following it and not getting yourself in jail. Okay. 3.5. We'll finish this section 3. Civil religion and toleration. The final chapter of Social Contract expounds Rousseau's doctrine of civil religion. Contemporary readers were scandalised by it, particularly by its claim that true Christianity is useless in fostering the spirit of patriotism and social solidarity necessary for a flourishing state. In many ways, this chapter represents a striking departure from the main themes of the book. First, it is the occasion where Rousseau prescribes the content of law that the just republic must have. Second, it amounts to his acceptance of the inevitability of pluralism in matters of religion. and such religious toleration, and thus of religious toleration. This is in some tension with his encouragement elsewhere of cultural homogeneity and propositions environment for the emergence of general will. Third, it represents a very concrete example of the limits of sovereign power, following John Locke. Rousseau insists upon the inability of the sovereign to examine the private benefits of beliefs of citizens. The tenets that this Rousseau's civil religion include the affirmation of the existence of the supreme being and of the afterlife, and the principle that the just will prosper and the wicked will be punished, and the claim that the social contract and the laws are sacred. In addition, the civil religion requires the provision that all those willing to tolerate others should themselves be tolerated, but those who insist that there is no salvation outside their particular church cannot be citizens of the state. Isn't that amazing? And I think there was the French actually created their own state religion in the revolution, and they had their own festivals and stuff like that. The structure of religious beliefs within the just state is that of an overlapping consensus. The documents of civil religions are that they can be affirmed by adherents of a number of different faiths, both Christian and non-Christian. Despite Rousseau's concern for religious toleration, both in this, in the chapter and elsewhere, modern readers, that's a self-christened cockatoo if you didn't know that overseas, despite Rousseau's concern for religious toleration, both in the chapter and elsewhere, modern readers have often been repelled by one striking note of intolerance. Rousseau argues that those who cannot accept the dogmas can be banished from the state. This is because he believes that atheists, having no fear of divine punishment, cannot be trusted by their fellow citizens to obey the law. He goes even further to suggest the death penalty for those who affirm the dogmas but later act as if they do not believe them. Well, there you go. Isn't that lovely? There's one very famous thinker who believed in the death penalty. I just can't believe him. Really struggle. And then there's John Locke, who had this entire state thing, except for Catholics. They had a view, except for Catholics, John Locke. And this person is, except for atheists you can banish. Learned ignorance. I've got to think of this person. So this person, who's a beautiful person to read. And then what did he want to do? Oh, he wanted the death sentence and to torture people. So it's these enlightened people, they're enlightened, but it unfolds rather dreadfully. So we've got a few more pages of this to get through. Thanks a lot for listening so far.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.